Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Here on Thursday, former Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land may be the GOP candidate for U.S. Senate next year. It appears more likely here today than yesterday. Michigan Congressman Justin Amash of West Michigan appearing to bow out yesterday with a tweet. So one by one, likely candidates have chosen not to run. Land, Peters, looking a lot more likely now next November. Jonathan Osting of MLive reports that the first TV ad for next year's Michigan Senate campaign is ready to go. The GOP ad will reportedly label Democrat Gary Peters as pure Washington. Of course, we've got an important football game coming up on Saturday. MSU-Notre Dame. A lot of anticipation here with an opponent. I mean, there's always a lot of anticipation against ND, but 3:30 kickoff in South Bend. How will the Spartans execute in their first away game of 2013 against Notre Dame? We shall see. At the top of our show today, back in July when state officials filed for federal bankruptcy protection for Detroit, worries spiked about other fiscally troubled U.S. cities. Our next guest is keeping an eye on several of those cities. Frank Shafroth is a noted municipal finance expert coming to Detroit tomorrow to participate in the Michigan Municipal League's annual meeting. Mr. Shafroth is a professor of public and international affairs at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He'll be releasing papers tomorrow updating the fiscal challenges facing not only Detroit, but five others as well. Frank Shafroth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The name of a panel session tomorrow is Detroit contagious? You seem to be just the guy to answer that question. Is Detroit contagious?
Detroit is a little bit contagious. It's contagious because there's a broad apprehension, obviously not just in Michigan, but across the country, that Detroit might be the leading edge. A lot of people seem to think a large number of cities are in serious fiscal trouble, and so their bonds are not something those people would want to buy. I think people take it a little bit out of context, because if you compare the annual number of corporate bankruptcies, you would see that the number of municipal bankruptcies is exceptionally small. Nevertheless, as you know better than I, Detroit's difficulties have received a lot of attention, as have those in San Bernardino and Stockton in California and Jefferson County in Alabama. So I think there is some widespread apprehension about cities and whether they're in trouble. And I think it will mean that for all cities, they will have to prepare for much greater scrutiny of what their fiscal condition is and what they're doing about it.
Can you explain just a little bit more briefly about the mechanics of these muni bonds, these municipal bonds? Apparently, when Detroit filed, this spooked a lot of investors who would ordinarily be considering municipal bonds as an investment vehicle. So that's the domino effect, basically, for lack of a better phrase, that you're talking about here, correct?
Yep, you're exactly right. Every city, every county, every state, and even the federal government issue bonds. They're really very similar to what someone who wants to purchase a home does. They take a long-term loan of some sort or another. therefore, Detroit, to build a sewer system, to build a jail, to build a sidewalk, issues bonds. There are different kinds of bonds, but part of what's captured some fear is in this bankruptcy, there is a possibility that some of the holders or owners of those bonds will not get their money back. The way a bond works, if you buy a Detroit so-called full faith and credit bond that's a 30-year bond, it means you will get payments on your bond rate somewhere around 4%. For 30 years, at the end of which you get your money back. Now, in this bankruptcy case, should the city be ruled eligible for bankruptcy, there is a possibility the city will not make the payments it's promised to bondholders.
Mm-hmm.
So some people say, well, if that's happening in Detroit, maybe that means that bonds sold by any city in America aren't so safe as we thought they were.
Both of today's Detroit newspapers have the same story as their headline story. I'd like to share the first paragraph of the Detroit News treatment of this and get your response. They write, "Emergency manager Kevin Orr is considering taking $1.2 billion designated for repairing the city's water and sewer system and spending the cash elsewhere, possibly on retiree pensions." Any particular response to that development?
Obviously, that would aggravate some fears amongst bondholders, in this case, a different kind of bondholders, but a fear that they're holding a piece of paper that they thought would provide them quarterly payments or semi-annual payments over the life of the bond, and all of a sudden, if they read the Detroit papers like you and I do every morning, there's a fear that that might not happen. So that can add to this angst. If I purchase an instrument issued by the city of Detroit, can I really have trust that the commitment to me will be honored?
So the city right now is entering a period where many of the city's biggest creditors, and those would include the retirees as well as all number of people, lenders, bondholders, they are urged, they're being urged to bend on the money that they're being owed. This will be playing out as you arrive in Detroit. Any thoughts on where we are in that process?
Well, where you are in the process is, number one, the big distinction. If when Eastern Airlines went bankrupt, they took the keys to all the planes, they took them to a U.S. bankruptcy court, and they said, "Your Honor, here are the keys. You can sell the planes, and you distribute the money equitably amongst all the creditors, so they'll all get 40% of what they are owed or whatever. It took a lot of years to help Congress understand that Detroit, Jefferson County are not the same way. If they're insolvent, they still have to respond to a 911 call. So Kevin Orr's concern here is he knows the city's running out of cash. He's got to prove to Judge Rhodes and the U.S. Bankruptcy Court that the city is insolvent. It does not have enough cash to pay for every commitment it must honor. And he's got to preserve enough to provide essential services to the citizens and taxpayers of Detroit. So the issue then is, who's not going to get fully paid? The retirees, the bondholders, the swap dealers, all those parties. So bankruptcy is this process. I think the city is really lucky. It's got Judge Rhodes running almost a Barnum and Bailey circus with colleagues from the federal court sitting as referees through this process, because it's very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. You and I can imagine how many lawyers are being paid really a lot of money to fight for their respective groups that have a stake in this.
Indeed.
So the longer Detroit's caught in the process of determining who's going to get what percent of what they're owed, the more money is going to go to lawyers instead of going to the retirees or to the, you know, the delivery of lighting on the streets that are not lighted in Detroit, or to hiring more police officers to deal with whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Those are those hard decisions that are going underway now. The sooner we get out of it, the better it is for Detroit. The longer we're there, the more funds are going to be siphoned off to pay for other people instead of getting Detroit back on its feet.
At your visit tomorrow, Professor Shafroth, you'll be releasing papers on five other very challenged American cities. But Detroit is one of them. What can you share? Can you share anything with us about what's going to be in your paper regarding Detroit?
What's going to be in my paper on Detroit is, this is probably the most difficult challenge of any city in the United States. It's lucky, as I say, it's got Judge Rhodes taking really some phenomenal leadership. It's got Kevin Orr, who's vowed to come out and Very differently than some other bankruptcies, views his goal as creating, in effect, a new Detroit. Not getting it out of bankruptcy and walking away, but getting the city really started again. When I compare what's happening in Detroit to the five other cities, it's behind. It's clearly not where, say, Baltimore is. You'll see in the paper on Baltimore that the state plays a very strong role and has been critical to Baltimore. What's interesting to me is five of the six cities are comparable to Detroit in that they are old manufacturing cities in America. They experience significant population losses. They have disproportionate levels of poverty and crime. And so it's observing the different ways they've reacted, their relationships with the state, and how it works. So lessons learned is going to be an important part. And I'm going to spend the next 3 months trying to cull out of there what are the most important lessons we can learn from these six cities that will help every single leader of every city, every town, every county, and hopefully every state in the United States.
So many other things to talk about, but we are out of time. Frank Shafroth is a professor of public and international affairs at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He's en route to Detroit for the Michigan Municipal League Conference tomorrow. Thank you, Professor Shafroth.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The massive renovation of the former J.W. Knapp department store continues in downtown Lansing. The historic 190,000-square-foot building is being converted into a mix of retail and residential space. Architects and developers are being careful to keep some of the original charm of the 75-year-old landmark, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The Knapp's project is a good example of how federal and state historic preservation tax credits are used to blend old form with new function. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with Rob McKay, a historical architect with the Michigan State Historic Preservation Office. They walked through the old Knapp Center, which is slated to reopen for business in February.
At the moment, what we're seeing is the new building skin going back on. The building is being rehabilitated as a combination of retail office and residential space.
This was a pretty classic example of Art Deco from the late Depression era. What do we know about the physical characteristics of this building that made it historic, that made it worth salvaging, worth having as part of our repertoire of what Lansing is?
There's two parts to that. First of all, or originally, the building was listed on the National Register of Historic Places individually, and it was listed for two reasons. You hit on one of them, that it's an iconic architecture, which is, in the history of Lansing, fairly unique. We don't have a lot of streamlined modern or art modern buildings. And then secondly, for its association with the Knapp's company itself. Knapp's was the preeminent department store retailer for a substantial period of time, and you know this was their flagship building. So that's why the building was originally listed. Subsequent to that, it was included in the Downtown Lansing Historic District, which includes a majority of the properties on Washington, and was recognized as a collection of buildings that clearly represent the history of the city, as opposed to this one, which was very unique in that overall story.
Well, how about we go inside and see what kind of progress is being made right now?
Wonderful.
All right. Is this the atrium, or eventually will be the atrium?
This is the new atrium. And actually, when we came in through the stairs, you encountered one of the other unique aspects of the project. Because of the footprint of the building and the way the floor plate was laid out, the spaces got very dark in the middle. So part of the design was to try to enliven the space, make it more modern, more friendly, and to get some additional light in, because all the glass block transmits light, but not as much as clear glass. An atrium has been inserted in the center, goes from the third floor to the roof, creates a broader, brighter space. But the other thing, if you look at the floor, you'll notice that all the ductwork is on the floor instead of on the ceiling. Because of the height of the band of glass block, we're using what is in effect an upside-down mechanical system. Everything will be fed from the floor, allowing the occupants in the space more direct contact with the exterior windows.
How exactly is your office involved with this project? Certainly it's an old historic building, but what brings SHPO on board?
In this case, specifically, we're involved with the federal and state historic tax credit programs. Those are incentives to encourage the owners of National Register listed buildings to rehabilitate them in a way that maintains the historic integrity of those properties while accommodating the new use or uses that we need to give to buildings to allow them to continue into the future.
Is it more difficult or more onerous for a developer to apply for the type of tax preservation, the historic preservation tax credits and incentives that it takes to do a property like this?
Is it more onerous? That's a very difficult question to answer. Yes, inherently preservation projects are more expensive than what I will say sometimes are conventional strip it, leave it, you know, make it into just this big empty kind of shell project. Is it more expensive than trying to build a contemporary comparable property? No, absolutely not, because the things, the materials, the products that you get that are inherent in a historic building are substantially more expensive than the conventional finishes and those kinds of things that we'd see in a new build today. So it you have to be careful how you make that comparison. Could you do a project for less than this one is costing? Yes. Would you get the same product? No. So, and that's part of what the credits are about, is to help level that playing field and try to make it as economically feasible to do a rehabilitation project as to do new construction.
Can you speak to the idea of what a renovated historic building like this means in terms of an anchor when a community wants to revitalize its historic business district?
Most of the time, if you look at truly successful communities, they are built around a historic core. There's something inherently that we as human beings react to but in the dynamic between the old and the new. It gives us a sense of safety and belonging as we sort of vault off into our new endeavors. So it's really important. You know, if you look at some of the most successful projects, arguably, in Lansing, they are rehabilitation projects. It was the Arbaugh project, was huge in sort of establishing a southern anchor for downtown and helping to sort of move some of the activity this way. The Motor Wheel Building on Saginaw was another really important project, again, in terms of solidifying that idea that downtown Lansing was really someplace that people wanted to be. Then there are a number of other small projects, you know, that have sort of taken that impetus. For us, the Knapps Building was really sort of the last major downtown building that hadn't had any substantial investment for an extended period of time. So we were really excited when the Ides came and said, yes, we think we want to do this, and we think we want to, you know, partner with you to make it happen.
I'm just going to take a guess here, Rob. As a historic architect, are you one of those guys that looks at a site as it's being torn apart and redone and says, whoa, don't touch that Ionic column. There's only three of these like this in the Midwest.
Well, unfortunately, yes, I do have a tendency to do that. As my wife says, you know, Rob, sometimes people do that because they really do think it's a good idea. I try to be understanding, but yeah, sometimes I react badly to what I see people doing.
The Knapps project is just the latest in a string of successful historic property renovations in Lansing. The city's downtown core and its Old Town District are each involved in a revitalization program administered by the Michigan Main Street Center, a division of the Michigan State Housing Development Authority. Brittany Hoskew is the organization specialist for the Michigan Main Street Center. We talked about the key role historic preservation plays in her agency's programming.
Historic preservation is really the foundation for the Main Street program. These historic preservation efforts are logging some extremely impressive private investment statistics. In Michigan alone, of 10 years of Main Street, we've had over $100 million of private investment in the Main Street communities that we work with. And so those economic development statistics being rooted in historic preservation are starting to gain the attention of all sorts of folks, Chamber of Commerce and downtown development authorities and principal shopping districts and local governments. And so, that historic preservation piece is a foundational piece, but it's also proven itself as an economic development piece as well, which makes it a welcomed addition to the program.
How does a program like yours entice developers who might be thinking about building brand new to look again at a vacant building or an underused building or a building that can be rehabilitated in some way versus something that's brand new?
Sure. I think if you look at the support that's out there now in the state of Michigan for downtown development efforts or for development efforts, period, you'll see that that's really being focused in downtowns and particularly in historic buildings. I think most everyone in the community development world in Michigan and even local governments have heard a lot of conversation around placemaking. And a lot of that is found within context and identity of communities, and that's in historic preservation. And so as a developer, if you're looking for those areas of support from local and state governments, it's really going to be found in downtown and existing historic properties.
The Michigan State Housing Development Authority is hosting a national Main Streets conference in Detroit in May of next year. Proposals from various communities across the country are being funneled into your office now from people who could present ideas for the rest of the country at this conference. Are you seeing some of those ideas? Are you parsing through some of those and getting a sense of, wow, that's something that we could do here that we never thought of that's happening in another state?
Well, my role really has been advocating for communities across the state to use this as a spotlight. So when the Michigan Main Street Center started to pursue hosting the National Main Streets Conference in Detroit in 2014, we knew that if we were going to move forward and invest our time in this fashion, in allowing Michigan to host such a conference, that we wanted to use it as a platform to show not just what Detroit's doing in community-initiated downtown development, and historic preservation, but what Michigan's doing, both in Michigan Main Street communities and beyond. And so I've really tried to focus my time in encouraging organizations of all shapes and sizes and missions to throw their hat in the ring and propose a potential topic that I think will help people across the country think differently maybe about their own community.
What's the most pleasantly surprising part about watching any city's downtown core get revitalized or noticed again or made profitable again?
I really find the most exciting part of a community that sort of finds themselves as seeing the community through the local stakeholders' eyes, seeing them become inspired and find their place in that process, to me is the most exciting part. Because whatever result comes out of their Main Street efforts, I think the most important thing is the understanding and excitement about their community and their friends and neighbors and what the possibilities are.
Brittany Hoskew is the organization specialist for the Michigan Main Streets Center at MSHDA, the Michigan State Housing Development Authority. Brittany, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to see you again.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State. The MSU Department of Theater is presenting the play Widows through this weekend at the Arena Theater in the Auditorium Building. It's a play by Ariel Dorfman, thought to be about the disappearing of Chilean men during the Pinochet regime. In his play, a village of women band together to defy the nation's military. The director of the play is Anne Folino White, assistant professor of theater at Michigan State, and she joins us now. Talk a little bit about what the play is about without giving too much away.
It's written by Ariel Dorfman, who lived in exile from Chile. He's a Chilean American. He's actually a professor now at Duke University. But it's based upon his experiences under Pinochet's regime and the political practice of disappearing political subversives and the tactic of terrorizing people by arresting individuals without cause and basically disappearing them, never to return.
Disappearing them?
Yes.
Okay.
Disappearing them. So that what I mean by that is they would be arrested. The military officials would deny their arrest, would deny knowledge of the individual, and people are still waiting in Chile and other places for the return of individuals that had been taken from them in
40
the 70s.
Years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How is it the MSU Department of Theater decided to do this particular play?
Well, the production season selection process takes into account the educational mission of the university department, as well as, so we look for plays that challenge our students in terms of the aesthetics, in terms of the number and kinds of roles that it can offer students, as well as the subject matter that will challenge them and be relevant to their lives.
Ariel Dorfman had been a part of the Salvador Allende government before Pinochet. And much of Dorfman's writing deals with the suffering of people under dictators. How often have you been involved with a play involving so much violence?
Well, the reason that I actually am directing the play is because a lot of my research involves political theater. I look a lot at protest and the theatrical tactics used in protest and civil disobedience of all sorts. And so the types of plays that I choose as an educator and a director for the theater department tend to involve those issues.
You talked about being interested in theatrical protest. How is Widows a play about theatrical protest?
It's a play about a really interesting form of resistance, which this is the plot of the play. The women are waiting and have been waiting for their men to be returned. And the military continues to insist to them that the war is over. And if they will only behave and if they will only look to the future rather than waiting for the past, progress will come and they will be happy. But they must behave, and they must forget about the men. The women refuse to do that. And one woman in particular, Sophia, who is the grandmother and the matriarch of the village, you might think of her, says to the men, "I will just wait by the river. I will wait by the river for my father and my husband and my sons to be returned." And through the power of her waiting, her patience, her unwillingness to forget the past, men start to magically appear. And as the men begin to appear, the other women begin to see the power of their refusal, of Sophia's refusal to forget the past, and join together, and they all start waiting.
Describe your set for us and how it evolved.
The set evolved in, obviously, collaboration with the scenic designer, Kirk Domer, who's also the chair of the Department of Theater. And in terms of Dorfman's desire for this lack of place, we were really interested in bringing out the theatrical elements, not creating a full-blown illusion where the audience, where we would pretend as if we weren't in a theater, would be one way to put it. And so it's a very rough construction of a river that's comprised of pallet wood. And at the center of these rough streams that flow across the stage that are not wet, there is a large horse trough, which has been filled with water. And what's really magical for me about it and theatrical about it, you know, as an audience member, you look at it and you know it is not a river. You are acutely aware that you are watching theater in the storytelling mode. But when a hand goes in the water and you hear the sound that is like no other and you see the reflection of the lights on the water, it is incredibly magical in the way that the characters in Widows, the women, sit and wait, and magically the bodies of the men are returned to them through the river. And so that element, that natural element of water, becomes greater than anything the theater might imagine.
What was it like to have to get your actors into a place where they could identify with this extraordinary set of circumstances and repression like this?
Yeah. I had them engage with a lot of research on the circumstance because it is so distant for them, both culturally and in terms of their experience as young people. We looked at a lot of information on people waiting for the disappeared to be returned. We also discussed the psychological and emotional damage that waiting with no end and uncertainty might cause. That was really one way we tapped into it, is the shifting ground, the lack of sense of any real truth in the world, and the fear that comes along with that. So that's really the way we tapped in. Most of the characters that they are playing are older than themselves, and so we discuss the experience of fear and waiting rather than playing age or playing place or dictatorship.
Once a young actor starts to understand the story, Do you see reactions in them to this as real history?
Absolutely, absolutely. We're actually pairing this performance on Thursday night following with the One Book, One Community selection from this year, Kevin Powers' Yellowbirds. And so a number of the students can have made that connection for themselves with our current state of war at a distance with war at home. And so they have full knowledge of its historic implications and the possibilities that it's not exclusive to one place and one time, but that it is a pattern of political repression that has been exercised globally and at different periods.
Dorfman set the plot of his novel that this play is based on. He set the plot of his novel in Greece in 1942, apparently to make it a little less about his own experience in Chile, I take it. But and the stage version is not specific, although it has certain clues suggesting Latin America. Do you find people want to assign historical places and times to it, even maybe current events to the messages in a play?
Yes, I think that they do, and I think that Dorfman is very careful in both the writing of the short story, which then he transformed into the play, as you said, to make audiences acutely aware that it isn't just the past, that, and it's not necessarily remote from those of us today, or that, in other words, we're not safe from it, somehow guarded from this type of violence and chaos, that it's possible anywhere. Dorfman, when he writes about the play, writes very specifically about the importance of not locating it in a specific moment in history or locating it in a specific place. He has made up the fictional town of Camacho, and the characters do have Spanish names. But other than that, the only indication that you're given is that it's in an arid area by a river.
He wants it to be universal.
He wants it to be universal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You attended MSU studying to be an actor. Today you teach and direct. Can you talk to us about the sparks between acting and directing?
The sparks between acting and directing. I think that what I learned about myself when I was studying theater as a young person and acting was that acting is very concentrated on an individual journey. And it's an important skill. My skill tends to be teaching. And directing for me is about teaching. And teaching for me is about the building of community around ideas and the building of dialogue among people who think very differently and learn very differently and have different life experiences. And so directing and teaching for me are very much one in the same. And so I like being among people and around people and discussing difficult ideas and contradictions that we all live with and exercise every single day. And so for me, directing allowed that to happen in a way that acting did not.
Anne Foligno-White is assistant professor of theater at Michigan State, and she is the director of Widows, which is on stage this weekend here at Michigan State University. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you for having me.
You're tuned to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Over 200,000 people from around the world have volunteered to leave their life on Earth behind to become part of the first human colony on Mars. The project, titled Mars One, aims to settle humans on the Red Planet by 2023. Current State's Emmanuel Berry found out that the people who will man this mission are everyday people like this Michigan native.
My name is Erica Mazaris. I am an applicant for the Mars One mission to Mars.
Thousands and thousands of people have applied, and they're vying to be the selected few who get to complete this mission to Mars. Why did you decide to apply?
I decided to apply to go to Mars because Mars has always been my dream. Ever since I was a little kid reading science fiction books, up until when I joined the University of Michigan's Mars rover team and worked for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Mars has always been my dream, and I'm so excited that there's finally the opportunity for someone like me to go.
So you made an application video. Let's listen to that now.
I can't tell you how excited I am to be making this video. Since I joined the University of Michigan's Mars rover team in early high school, I've been in love with Mars. That I'm now actually applying to be a crew member on a human expedition to Mars is my wildest fantasy come true. I know, pretty tame fantasies, huh?
I think you really get a sense of your love for space in that video. Tell me a little bit about where this love stems from.
I think it all started with the stories. I honestly do. And it's weird to think that, you know, the weird science fiction, like John Carter Mars type things are what have inspired me to actually do something real, because I don't want anyone to mistake that. Like, I don't think there are actual like giant Martians living on Mars right now. That's not where I'm at. But you get these stories of grand adventures, of people willing to sacrifice what they have for the betterment of humanity, of society, and then to put that in a space opera setting. And then you get these people that are traveling to explore because that's what we as humans do. And that is what I was raised on as a kid. That's what I grew up with. So that's always been deep inside me somewhere.
With this mission, you're leaving Earth, potentially not to return. I guess, does that scare you?
It absolutely scares me. I mean, there's no way that it doesn't at least a little bit scare every single one of those applicants. But I think the important thing to remember is that while it does scare us, the excitement of going to Mars and what we can accomplish there is so much greater than the fear that we have.
What do you think you'd miss about Earth if you were selected?
So you haven't seen back behind the curtains yet, but my husband and I have a lot of pets. He's actually going to school to be a zookeeper, so we have a lot of reptile rescues and things like that. And you've seen some cats wandering out here. So I'll miss my animals. I really will. They're like my children right now.
What excites you about the potential of living a life on Mars?
It's really hard to imagine what living a life on Mars would be like, because everything about it, from the sunrise to the air we breathe to the people that we'll be with, are just like unimaginable at this point in time. And I think that's what excites me the most. Like, this is an experience that no human has ever had before. This is something entirely new, and that's so incredibly exciting.
What's the training process like for this, for those who are selected?
It sounds like, from what Mars One has said on their website and everything, it sounds like it's a 7-year training process where we'll be trained in everything necessary to make us good astronauts, which is good because I'm clearly missing some of those skills right now. But they'll train us in everything that we'll need to survive and to thrive on Mars and do carry out all of the science experiments that we can.
So you mentioned you don't necessarily have all the skills yet, but what skills do you have, you think, that make you an asset to potentially being a part of this mission?
I think the biggest skill that I have, and I think the most important skill that anyone on this Mars One mission could have, is the ability to learn and to learn quickly and to adapt to any situation. Because Mars One can train us. They can train, you know, people in the Air Force that are in the astronaut program as we speak for 7 years to go to Mars. And I guarantee you that they'll face a new situation every day that they weren't prepared for. So the key is to be able to handle those situations. That's what it's all about. And I think I and a lot of my fellow applicants have that ability. I think that's key.
Your background is in linguistics. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Look, my background's all over the place. I went to college on a math and science scholarship and a dance scholarship. So I majored in classical languages. And then I came back to Ypsilanti, to Eastern Michigan University, and got my master's in linguistics and artificial intelligence. And now I work as a computer software developer.
Do you know if you will get to bring anything with you? And I guess if you were able to, what three things would you want to take with you to Mars?
I don't know if we'll get to bring anything with us. I hope so. And I hope I don't have to include in my list of things that I want to bring, like, you know, electronic media, like books or music. I hope they just, like, have some available to us. I think what I would bring, if I could, is back when my husband and I were just starting to date, he took a trip to Hawaii and brought me back this little, like, 4-inch-long stuffed finger puppet of a mongoose. And that was, like, the first gift he'd ever given me. So I took that mongoose with me everywhere I went, from, you know, Greece to California to Hawaii myself. It's always been with me. And I feel like if I could take that mongoose to Mars, that would be what I'd do.
So if selected, you'd also, I guess, be leaving your husband behind as well. I guess, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. I will say that before we started dating even, he knew about my love for Mars and outer space. And that was a caveat to our starting to date, was that if I had the opportunity to go to outer space, that I'd take it. But he is a phenomenal human being and an amazing husband. And he has said that if I do get to go to Mars, he'd like to follow me. So he'd do what he could to get in the training program as well and get to Mars too. So I'm trying not to think about leaving him behind. It's just moving us both to Mars.
I think a lot of people look at this idea of this mission and think, this is crazy. Why would anyone want to do this? There's so much risk. I guess, what do you have to say to that?
I have a couple things to say to that. And the first is that we rely on this kind of exploration and adventure. And we have always relied on this kind of exploration and adventure to further the human race, to get us the scientific and technological advances that have gotten us to where we are today. We've relied on exploration to even, you know, bring us over into America, you know. So I think that it is absolutely our place to continue that exploration into outer space. And the people that are, you know, that think all of the applicants are crazy, well, that's fine. They don't have to be the ones to go to Mars, as long as they don't stand in the way of the rest of us.
You kind of touched on it there, but why is space exploration so important? Why is it important that we start making these steps now?
When we do science experiments on Earth, we're limited to a certain amount of gravity, to a certain amount of atmospheres of pressure. You know, we're very Earth-centric in the science that we're doing. And if we can take away some of those variables, take away some of those constants and replace them with new ones, we're all of a sudden opening up a whole new realm of knowledge to us. And that benefits every science at a very broad level. But beyond that, beyond opening up new scientific doors, there's just the very basic idea of our need to keep exploring and keep pushing our boundaries. And while there are places on Earth, like the very bottom of the Marianas Trench, that we haven't explored yet, for the most part, we've seen the land on Earth, and we've seen what it has to offer, and there's nowhere else to go for us but up now.
Erica Mazaris is an applicant for the Mars One mission. She welcomed current state's Emmanuel Berry into her Ypsilanti home for that conversation. You're listening to WKAR's Current State. Over 100 years ago, it was a church, its stairwell under the feet of countless young brides as they stood at the top and tossed their bouquets. Decades later, it was a nightclub that laid claim to hosting some of the biggest national acts to come through Lansing. And then it was empty, sitting unused, but not forgotten. But not anymore. There are some new tenants using Old Town's Temple building. Current State's Becky McKendry took a trip to see just who's been occupying the space these days.
After a few years of vacancy, the Temple building on Grand River Avenue in Lansing's Old Town is alive again, in what could be the most fitting way possible. It has now been repurposed as a home for those who repurpose things. It's called a makerspace.
A makerspace is a community workshop, a place for people to come together and share ideas, to share tools, concepts, and have a place that they can come together, work together, share, and make together.
That's Brian Adams, the board president of the Lansing Makers Network. Now, his description's accurate, but it's a little conceptual, so let me paint a more detailed picture for you. This place is like the biggest garage you've ever seen. Like Chuck E. Cheese for engineers. Downstairs there's even a fully functional, life-size version of the board game Operation. There is stuff everywhere, in every corner and on every floor. Lumber, computer parts, old toasters, things that Brian says people use for all sorts of creations.
It kind of crosses all spectrums in terms of why people make. You know, some people make because it's a hobby and it's interesting to them. Some people make to fix things. And then some people are, you know, struggling entrepreneurs and budding inventors that want to create something new.
Makerspaces, which can also be called hackerspaces, are found all across the globe and date back to the 90s. Brian says that some of the ones already established in Michigan have been very valuable in terms of advice and inspiration for the Lansing Makers Network.
You know, there's a number of hackerspaces and makerspaces in Ann Arbor and Detroit and Grand Rapids, and it's just something that was kind of lacking in Lansing, and we thought we'd take it upon ourselves to take care of that.
Tonight, the group's having one of their regular weekly meetings. Around 10 or 15 members filter in and out. One member wanders upstairs to show a new guy a laser cutter. Another member attempts to maneuver a remote-controlled plane through a hula hoop that's been dangling from the light on the ceiling. And over near the drill press, Nick Kwiatkowski demonstrates one of his projects to another member.
So let it boot up for a second. Okay, so there you go.
Oh, there you go. All
right. Nick recently displayed this at a conference in Los Angeles. It's a project commonly known as persistence of vision, and as he'll explain, it's pretty cool.
This is actually a bike wheel that was designed for like bar crawls and things like that, where it can hook up to a mobile device, so like a cell phone or something like that, and you can write words on there or like have movies on there, and as you're riding along, you'll actually see like images in the bike wheel.
One of the men watching on is director and founding member Carl Raymond.
I'd been to other makerspaces, like in Ann Arbor. There's a really nice one that I'd been to a couple times to visit, and I'd wish that it was closer to me because it's just too far away to be practical. As I've told people, it's a thing I always wanted to do, but I just didn't know it.
Now it's something he wants to do all the time.
Oh, I'm here almost every day. In fact, I have to plan sometimes to not come here to get time to do other things. So everything at the house is suffering for, you know, from me being here all the time.
Sometimes people show up with a project in mind. Sometimes they show up to see what other people are doing. And sometimes they end up just having conversations about ideas that haven't even begun to manifest yet.
There you go. It does have floppies if you open it up, so things that still...
The group's also holding elections for the board tonight. Rosangela Canino-Koning is up for one of the open spots, but she's not that worried about it.
We haven't counted the ballots yet, but I'm pretty confident that that it's going to be fine because there's two openings and there's two people who are being nominated, so...
The Makers Network allows Rosangela to embrace her artistic and her technical sides, something that also comes out in the electronic art she makes. She actually used the makerspace to put the finishing touches on her piece, Helix. It was on display at the MSU Museum. Rosangela made the bulk of the piece elsewhere, but she said she definitely utilized the input of her fellow makers.
It's really nice to, you know, be able to bring your things here. Just, you know, even if you're not building it here, there's still a huge community of people that are totally interested in talking with you about whatever it is that you're working on and helping you work through your issues.
And that sense of community is what keeps Rosangela and all of the makers coming back, and why she says the Makers Network will just keep growing.
You can always find a way of, you know, renting equipment or borrowing equipment from someone, but finding other people of like interest is an incredibly difficult and very valuable thing. Lansing doesn't have to be a place where you don't know where anybody is. You don't have to go to Detroit or Ann Arbor or Grand Rapids to find a community of like-minded folks anymore. Now you can just come right here.
For Current State, I'm Becky McKendry.
And that's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Keep in mind, Power Hours are coming soon to WKAR Radio. Power Hours are a chance to shorten the time that we spend asking you to donate during our fall fundraising campaign. That campaign usually lasts a week. We can shorten that if we get enough of you, WKAR supporters who listen to Current State, who love the classical music, to contribute during one of our upcoming Power Hours. Be listening for those. They are coming soon here to 90.5. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we talk about Art Prize in Grand Rapids that kicked off this week. We preview the Old Town Blues Fest that's happening in Old Town. We have live music in the studio tomorrow, Frog and Matchett tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Take care.